Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about America's favorite homegrown monster, Bigfoot. He always makes news. Last fall, for example, when two men from rural Georgia said they had the body of a Bigfoot, reporters from all over flocked to their news conference, and thousands of stories followed around the world. This morning in this hour, we'll be talking with Joshua Blue Booz about his book, The Life and Times of a Legend, Bigfoot. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. He says that Bigfoot is part of the American cultural landscape, and understanding the monster, why we're fascinated by Bigfoot, helps us to explain some of 20th century America. The book is out now. You might want to take a look at it. He's also the author of an earlier book, The Fire Ant Wars, which was also published by the University of Chicago Press. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just be brief in their questions and comments so we can keep moving. But questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Booz, hello.
Hello. How are you doing? Thank you for having me.
Good. Well, thanks thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate you giving us some of your time. I'm sure we'll talk in some detail about Bigfoot, about the Yeti, about some of these sorts of creatures. But I guess the point to start with maybe is, while people have indeed heard about the abominable snowman, and they have no doubt heard stories about Bigfoot in the United States, they're apparently, while it's not universal, different people, different places around the world have as their folk cultures stories about creatures that answer to this general description.
Yes, that's very true. In China, for example, there's what's called the Wairen, and then Russia has a series of creatures, most famously the Almas. There are similar creatures in Central America, and you could find the stories pretty much across the world, not so much in Africa, but pretty much everywhere else.
Yeah. Probably the outside of the United States, I expect, probably the most famous wild man creature of this kind, and something that truly got attention around the world, is the Yeti, the abominable snowman that allegedly was suspected to have existed and got a lot of attention around the time when there was a lot of international attention focused on the effort to summit Everest. And it seems that it was all touched off by a footprint.
Yes, exactly. Eric Shipton, who was probably at the time Britain's most famous mountaineer, was leading one of the reconnaissances up to try to conquer Everest. And on one day, he and his companion Michael Ward and a local Sherpa guide found a series of footprints. And he said that you could see the toe prints quite clearly. You could see where the creature had jumped across a crevice and where its toes had grabbed onto the snow. And his guide told him that, yes, this was the wild man of the snows, the Yeti, or the abominable snowman. And so he was documenting his travels in the London Times, and he wrote about this discovery, sent in a picture, and this touched off a whole lot of interest in the abominable snowman and Yeti that persisted through most of the 1950s.
And this was something that people in this region, this was a kind of thing that they had as a part of their folk culture and had been there for a long time?
Yes, it is. It's not quite clear, at least to me, exactly how much the Wild Man of the Snows was accepted as a true and real creature versus kind of a spiritual creature. But there were certainly stories about it. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that in both cases of the Yeti and Bigfoot, it seemed that for a lot of people, and there are some exceptions, but for a lot of people, the main evidence, all there was a footprint. There was a footprint there. There were footprints here. Now, people in Tibet, I guess, have had things that they said they thought were pieces of Yeti hide, and I guess from time to time people have claimed to have body parts, I guess hands, pretty much. But it's interesting that so much rested on in so many people's minds, the existence of these things, so much rested on so little evidence.
I think that's true to an extent. The Yeti, especially in the local folklore of the Tibetans and Nepalese, there were actually a lot of stories of the creature having been seen. And certainly when Bigfoot started out in North America, almost all the evidence was footprints. And only much later did you get reports of it being seen or of pictures or something. But yes, and the footprints then have kind of attracted a lot of attention. And this is where a lot of the focus has been on the anatomy of the footprints and on what we can find out from the footprints.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of attempts were there made in Tibet to actually see if this creature could actually be found?
So after Eric Shipton published the picture of the footprints, there were a series of expeditions. One of them was sponsored, the first one was sponsored by the Daily Mail of London newspaper. And this was in 1954. And they sponsored Ralph Izzard, who was a traveling journalist. And he brought with him several biologists and several people who'd been on an earlier successful attempt to climb Mount Everest. And they went out looking for the beast. They found some of the same kind of evidence that you've referred to, some tracks, some tufts of hair, nothing that was really definitive. Later, an American, Tom Slick, he was a wealthy scion of an oil family in Texas, led a series of, I think there were three, attempts to find Bigfoot in the Himalaya, or I'm sorry, Yeti in the Himalaya. Mm-hmm. And they came back with footprints, with one of the hands that you referred to from the Pangbokchi Lamasery. And they studied these bits of evidence, and it didn't really add up to a whole lot. And finally, in the late 1950s, almost, and then into the 1960s, Sir Edmund Hillary, who had led the first attempt to conquer Mount Everest, led another group up looking for it. And he and his group debunked the existence of the Yeti. They said that the tracks that most people were finding were actually just impressions in the snow that had sublimated so that they took the shape of a foot, but they could be made by rocks, by ravens, by foxes. And his word was very authoritative. He was, at that time, the greatest mountaineer. He had summited Everest. And so that pretty much ended discussion of Yetis through the 1960s for the next 10 years.
Yeah. It's interesting that while on the one hand, stories about the Yeti really helped to establish the wild man in modern times, it seems that Ed Hillary's determination that, in fact, there was no such thing was enough to discredit the idea of a Bigfoot kind of creature in the mainstream.
Yes, I think that's true. And if you think about it, what he was saying is he's saying there's no Yeti in the Himalaya. And this kind of viscerally seems like the most likely place to find a wild primate, huge primate that we have never seen before, out in the far reaches of the Himalaya where a lot of people don't go. And so if you say, okay, there's none here, then the likelihood of there being some in more populated areas, more explored areas, just suddenly seems to decrease as well.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Joshua Blue Booz, and we're talking about his book, Bigfoot, The Life and Times of a Legend. It's published by the University of Chicago Press and takes a look at stories about Bigfoot-like creatures over time and some of the people who have been real believers and have gone looking and what it says about us that we find these stories so fascinating. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, to shift here to the United States, one of the things that I think is kind of curious is that while there have been reported sightings of Bigfoot at various places around the United States, it seems that the epicenter for Bigfoot is the Pacific Northwest, that the oldest stories seem to come from there. And there is, and perhaps it's explained by the fact that there's a considerable body of folklore about wild men in this part of the country.
I think there's no doubt that this is that the Pacific Northwest, Upper California, Oregon, Washington, southern Canada, is where the stories first took hold. And I think there's two trains going on there. One of those, you're right in suggesting that it's because there's this body of lore, and that's this tradition out of Canada, which talks about the Sasquatch. And in the 1920s, there was a teacher on the Chehalis Reservation named John Burns, and he was very interested in the folklore of his students. And he started asking them about the wild man of their tradition, which he anglicized their word as Sasquatch, and he wrote about this. And then there continues to be a tradition of people kind of writing about this and talking about this in Canada. And the idea of the Sasquatch then really took off in the 1950s, kind of on the heels of the Abominable Snowman. Also coming from the heels of the Abominable Snowman, you get this other story out of California. This is the story of Bigfoot. And this comes in 1958. There's a road building crew up in very, very far northern California, a very rural area. And one of the bulldoze operators, Jerry Crew, he finds a series of footprints around his bulldozer. And at first he thinks maybe it's a practical joke, but he starts talking to some of the other people on the work site, and they've heard about other kinds of footprints appearing in the area. And he starts investigating this more. He talks to a local taxidermist who wants to examine him. The taxidermist teaches him how to plaster cast them. And so Crew plaster casts the tracks, and then takes them into Eureka, California, which is the nearest real big town, and shows them off to the newspaper there. There's a newspaper columnist there named Andrew Gonzale. And Gonzale is fascinated by this, and he writes about this and in his local paper, but it's picked up by the news wires because of the interest in the Abominable Snowman at the time, and then kind of spreads out from there. And so the story in California doesn't really come out of kind of a long tradition of lore. It's more kind of just a momentary happening that's going on in the late 1950s there. But then this kind of blends with the Sasquatch story, and you get the two. And then you get the kind of the legend of the North American wild man evolving out of that.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that it seems that so much of this really was, well, these people had been telling these kind of stories in the Americas for who knows how long. And the term, as you said, the term that some people have heard, Sasquatch, comes from the indigenous people of the Pacific Northwest. And that was first, I don't know if it's fair to say coined, but it was this man, John Burns, that wrote about this back in the 20s, that it was all the coverage of the Yeti that really got people in the United States jazzed about this. And particularly, I think, people who, they heard this story of the Yeti, and there were people who, I think, genuinely thought, well, wouldn't it be amazing, cool, wonderful? I would like to discover such a thing. It seems that while there were many, many hoaxers, there were also some people who just were intrigued and entranced, I guess, by the idea of discovering something that nobody had ever seen before.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And in Canada, you have the perfect example is Rene de Hinden. Mm-hmm. Rene de Hinden had come over to Canada, had emigrated from Switzerland. He had lived a very Dickensian childhood. He'd been in and out of foster homes. And he came over, and he was working on a farm in Alberta when he heard over the radio of stories about the Abominable Snowman. And he said something to his employer to the effect of, wouldn't it be great to find something like that? And the farmer was apparently aware of the stories coming out of British Columbia about the Sasquatch. And he said, he told DeHinden about this. And so DeHinden pretty much picked up as soon as he could. He got to British Columbia and started looking into the whole Sasquatch stuff. He started going through newspaper archives, started reading old books. He started talking to people. He talked to newspaper writers and really devoted his life to it in some amazing ways. Later on, his wife would get tired of his hobby, I guess, and rather than give that up, he said he was willing to divorce his wife, and the work he took on was very menial. He worked at a shooting range, and what he would do is he would go out and he would collect the lead shot that had fallen to the ground and then recycle it. And this way he could work on his own hours, make enough money he needed to go out in the woods whenever he wanted and hunt and look for the Sasquatch.
Yeah. And the term Bigfoot, as you explained, this comes into common use in, the late 1950s, after this incident where this person who was working on this road crew saw these big footprints and he made plaster casts, and so they were big feet. So that's how it is that it came to be called Bigfoot. In this particular case, though, I think eventually there was, at the time, I think maybe there was some suspicion that it was a hoax and a particular person was implicated. And the windup is that eventually, once that man died, his family came forward and said, yes, he did it. It was a hoax. And in fact, in the book, you've got a picture of one of these mans. I'm not sure if that was a son or a grandson. It probably must have been a son holding up big carved wooden feet that this guy had made that he had used to make the footprints.
Yes, exactly. So, reset the stage. It was Jerry Crew was working on, was this bulldozer operator who found these prints. His boss on the site, the construction company that was doing this work was run by three brothers. One of whom was Ray Wallace. Ray Wallace was a well-known prankster, practical joker, and a lot of the local people suspected that he might have been the ones who was putting the footprints out there, just as a joke, as a hoax. And word kind of percolated through, and Some people in the town started to get a little bit nervous about this and wanted to maybe end the joke and end the mystery. And one of the local papers has said that, hey, we know who it is. We're going to tell the police department or the sheriff's department, and they're going to shut him down. And it turned out that this was all directed at Ray Wallace. But when the sheriff's department approached him, he said, I had nothing to do with it. This was not me at all. But his story changed in ways that were not very convincing. So at one point he said, I've seen these tracks before, they're only bears. And then at another point he started spinning yarns about how these were wild man tracks, and he'd seen the wild man many times, and the wild man lived out in the woods and tended to cattle. And he became infamous in the Bigfoot community over the 60s and the 70s because his stories kept evolving, and he kept trying to cash in on things. He made records of songs with supposed Bigfoot calls incorporated into it. He told stories of the Bigfoots he had captured and the gold that they had and how they were friends with cougars and they talked to each other. And so people started to write him off as just kind of a lunatic and not believe anything he said. And as part of that, they kind of started disbelieving that he could have been in on the hoax at the beginning. And then, yes, he did. Ray Wallace did die in 2002, and it was actually his nephew, Dale Wallace, who came forward and said, yeah, my uncle did do all this. He started it all. And he showed some of the wood-carved feet that bore a uncanny resemblance to a lot of the early plaster casts that Jerry Crew and others had found.
And it seems that for those people who are Bigfoot true believers, who at least want to leave open the possibility that there is such a thing, they themselves would admit that there have been an awful lot of hoaxes, and that maybe predominantly things that have been offered as evidence are hoaxes. I'm sure that that annoys them, but it seems that it's not enough to lead them to think, well, maybe the whole thing is a humbug, and there's really no point in treating it seriously.
Oh, yes, and I think the number you get bantered around a lot in the Bigfoot community is they'll say 70 to 80% of the evidence just isn't good. Part of that is hoaxing, part of that is misidentification, but what they really concentrate on is that other 20 to 30% that can't be explained away very easily, and the kind of that's what they want to understand. That's what they want to focus. That's what they want to focus on.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Joshua Blue Booz. He's the author of the book Bigfoot: The Life and Times of a Legend. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. He's an independent scholar, author of the previous book, The Fire Ant Wars. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, certainly this the story here is a story of a lot of really interesting characters, and one person in particular who I think was very important in, say, popularizing the idea of Bigfoot. One of the more interesting guys here is a fellow named Ivan Sanderson. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Ivan Sanderson was he was born in Scotland in 1911. And he grew up very interested in natural history and nature. And when he was young, he was able to take a trip around the world, study a number of plants and animals. And then when he graduated college, he did a number of expeditions, also collecting plants and animals for kind of the British Museum of Natural History and places such as that. After World War II, he moved to the United States, moved to New Jersey, became a citizen, and kind of made himself out to be a popular naturalist, so in magazines, on the radio, on TV. He also had a really developed interest in unusual, unexplained natural phenomenon, such as wild men. And in the 1950s, he started focusing almost all of his attention on this rather than on more mainstream ideas. And in the course of this, kind of came across the story of Bigfoot that was developing out of California. He went there to see for himself what was going on, then also went up into Canada and talked to some of the people who were integral there. And he turned around and wrote these articles for what were at the time called men's adventure magazines. It's not really a genre of magazine that we recognize anymore, but they were kind of aimed at working class fishing huntermen, told sometimes straightforward stories, later on more lurid and made-up stories. And he was really key in popularizing the whole idea of Bigfoot, because he wrote for True Magazine, which was the biggest of the men's adventure magazines, sold about 2 million copies a month. And so he really kind of got the idea that there was this Bigfoot out there into American popular culture.
Yeah. And now some people would just say, well, this was just a variety of pulp fiction, they might indeed, some people might read these stories and just think, well, kind of get a chuckle out of them. But as far as he was concerned, this fellow, Ivan Sanderson, he actually believed that these things did exist.
As best I can tell, he's kind of a slippery character, sometimes hard to get a hold of. But as best I can tell, I was able to visit the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, which holds his personal papers, his correspondence, and diaries and such. And it's everything there seemed that he really believed that yes, there were these wild men. Bigfoot, one of several varieties that were around the world, actually.
We have a caller here to talk with over in Belgium, Illinois, not all that far away, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning. You actually touched on the question I was going to have, and that was the fact that isn't this kind of like a modification, a bastardization, shall we say, Paul Bunyan type things and Babe the Blue Ox and all these American legends, instead of being exactly the same thing, it's just kind of a strange little twist on it?
Well, I don't know that you can make the connection directly to Paul Bunyan, for example, but that you could certainly sit Bigfoot into kind of American folklore more generally. There's a whole tradition of among loggers and road builders and people who work out in the woods of telling stories about fabulous creatures, about hodags, for example, which were the rhinoceros of the North Woods and supposedly lived in Wisconsin and ate porcupines, or Willamalones, which are squirrel-like creatures that would drop pellets on the eyes of sleeping men and cause them to have nightmares. And there's the Sidehill Winders and all these creatures. And there's this entire bestiary of American fabulous creatures, and Bigfoot nestles in that very nicely.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that that gets us into some of the interesting speculation about what the great appeal of creatures like this is. And there seemed to be a variety of things for some of the people who were true believers. I think it was partly for them, it was just the idea of the thrill of discovering something that nobody had ever discovered, or something that had been rumored to exist. And now they would actually be the one to say, "You see, here it is. I actually did find it." But for other people, particularly for people who are just reading the stories, who maybe were reading these men's adventure magazines, then the question becomes, well, what really is the fascination with a creature like this?
That's exactly right. And that was one of the questions that was posed to me, and I think was one of the hardest with this project, because what I kept confronting, I originally just wanted to say, to write the story Bigfoot, not sure exactly how it would turn out. But I was confronted over and over again that in the 1960s and 1970s, the main place that Bigfoot was coming up was in these men's adventure magazines and these cheap movies that were made for that same kind of audience. And so the question became, why the appeal between Bigfoot and these particular kinds of consumers, these particular kinds of readers and movie watchers? And so the best answer that I could come up with was there's this symbiotic relationship between those who produced the magazines, people like Ivan Sanderson, those who read the magazines, and the Beast. So the Beast is serving some kind of purpose. And I could kind of get a sense of what was going on with the people who were writing the magazines, because they left a record. The people who were reading the magazines had less of a way of understanding what they were doing. They didn't tend to leave records of why they read the stories or what they found interesting about it. And so what I tried to do was I tried to make my best guess about what they were doing by kind of reading these stories, interpreting these stories against the context of the time. And so my argument is that in the 1960s and 1970s, these particular kinds of readers, the white working class men, especially of rural America, but of other places as well, were feeling very besieged. There was a big change in the economy that was taking a big bite out of their economic position. Real wages were stagnating. At the same time, you had the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the anti-war movement, all of which were directed, or were not directed, but were seen by white working class men as attacks on their traditional privileges. And so then Bigfoot, if you read the stories about Bigfoot in these magazines, if you see the movies, what you start to see is that Bigfoot kind of works as a way of, Bigfoot operates as a way of working through these concerns. In some of the stories, Bigfoot operates as a personification of the threats to the white working class men. It's this monster. It's emasculating. It beats them down. And there are some examples that are very graphic and pointed about just how much Bigfoot emasculates men in these stories. Then there are other stories where Bigfoot is actually the hero and is seen as representing the kind of traditional values, the emphasis on craftsmanship and artistry that is getting lost as the economy changes, as we become a consumer society, as working class men lose their place. And so they kind of identify with Bigfoot, I argue, as a metaphor for their own kind of possible extinction. And then there is a kind of a third set of stories, which are interesting in that they kind of combine these two trends, where Bigfoot is both something that's threatening, it's the other, it's a woman, it's a black man, but Bigfoot is also, for that very reason, heroic. And this is kind of a so that the stories are in some ways kind of subversive in that they allow white working class men to experience parts of themselves that they were otherwise cut off from. So, for example, there's a book by Walter Sheldon that came out in late 1970s. It's called The Beast, and it's about this creature named Self. And so the reader is kind of forced to identify with the main character, Self, who is a female Bigfoot. And it's through the story, the Bigfoot is also characterized in ways that ally it with minorities. And so the presumptive reader, the white working class man, is being made to identify with this female beast, this minority. And at the end, the Self is the only survivor of this great battle and is in touch with the laws of nature and is about to give birth. And so there's this way in which the white working class readers were able to read themselves into the body of the beast and experience things that they felt they were otherwise cut off from.
Yeah. I think it's really fascinating that so many of these stories contain, and maybe the larger story sort of contains this interesting mix of that it's both something to be afraid of and something to admire.
Yes, yeah, and I what's interesting about that, I think, is it goes also beyond the stories. There's this kind of real tension in the Bigfoot community about how to approach the beast. The biggest probably dividing line in the Bigfoot community is whether it should be killed if it was ever found, or whether it should be left alone, and what either one of those would do to believers. What would it mean for somebody who'd sought this beast and respected this beast for so long to actually have to kill it in order to bring it into science, or what would it mean for them not to kill it, to let it go, let it be free and wonderful, but then also know that the rest of the world will never believe them.
Yeah. Another story here I want you to talk about is the Patterson-Gimlin movie that I think is for a lot of people who are true believers, seems to be one of the best pieces of evidence that they would marshal for the existence of the creature. And I'm sure expect probably people have seen this, or maybe they've seen it parodied, that purports to be a film of Bigfoot. How did this come about?
Yeah, this is probably the iconic image of Bigfoot that most people have in their mind. Mm-hmm. It shows the hairy beast shuffling across the forest, looking back over its shoulder. This came out in October of 1967. So in the years leading up to this, after Edmund Hillary had kind of disproved to his satisfaction, the abominable snowman, interest in Bigfoot had declined quite a bit. But Roger Patterson, who was a kind of a small town con man up in Yakima, Washington, he did this and that and had lots of grand ideas that he never really fulfilled, plans of get-rich schemes and what have you. And he'd become interested in Bigfoot based on some of Ivan Sanderson's writings and decided he was going to make a movie about Bigfoot. And he was going to make this movie with some of his friends in Yakima, one of whom was Bob Gimlin. And as part of the movie, they decided that they wanted to get some footprints. And they heard tell that there had been some footprints seen recently down in Northern California, in the same area where Jerry Crew had found his. And so they went down there, supposedly to film these prints and to stay down for a while. And in the course of it was about 2 weeks that they were down there. One day, they were riding out along Bluff Creek and saw what, according to them, they saw a female Bigfoot walking along the creek. And Roger Patterson hopped down really quickly. He got his camera out, and he filmed about, it ended up being, I believe it was about 30 seconds, of the beast walking before it disappeared into the copse of trees. They came back out of the woods with this, very excited. Their brother-in-law Roger Patterson's brother-in-law up in Yakima received the film, presumably had it developed. And a few days later, they were showing it off to some of their Bigfoot friends. People were really excited. And then Roger Patterson was kind of confronted with the problem of what to do with this. Some of the more dedicated Bigfoot hunters wanted him to take it to scientists immediately so that they can look at it, see that Bigfoot really existed, and the mystery would be ended. Patterson himself was more inclined to want to go to Hollywood or New York and sell it and make a lot of money. Apparently, the dedicated Bigfoot hunters were able to prevail upon him, and so he went and he showed it at the University of British Columbia to an assembly of biologists and anthropologists and others interested in it, most of whom either didn't believe it or said it was inconclusive. So Patterson kind of then decided to follow his other track, and so he went to Hollywood, tried to get a movie made out of it. He went to New York, tried to get some interest in the media there, and actually there he was helped by Ivan Sanderson again, who was able to get the first pictures put into one of the men's adventure magazines called Argosy. And this kind of really then kicked off the second round of Bigfoot mania that would then kind of coast into the 1970s.
Yeah. And here, at some time later, didn't someone say, yeah, actually, I was a guy and I was wearing this ape costume and that was me?
Well, there's actually been a couple of different claims about people claiming to be in on it. Ray Wallace was made some claims about knowing exactly who was in it. And then more recently, there was a book put out by Greg Long that purported to solve the mystery and say, yeah, it was just this guy named Bob Hieronymus in a costume. But that book itself is, it undermines itself, because at some point it describes the costume in very different ways and how it was made and stuff. So the mystery still remains. There's been really no definitive, nothing in my estimation is totally definitive that could say yes, it's a hoax, or yes, it's not a hoax. So it's that kind of ambiguity that makes it still really exciting to people.
All right. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Joshua Blue Booz, and his book is Bigfoot, The Life and Times of a Legend. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. We have somebody on a cell phone here from calling up around Paw Paw, so let's talk with them on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. How are you? I grew up up in the Northwest, and on occasion we'd have people have sightings of this mm-hmm. thing. I've never claimed to see it, but I've seen a plaster casting of what a Bigfoot paw prints would look like. And if I'm not correct, I think I recall a couple years ago where they caught some guy going around making prints and basically in a suit. Was half monkey, half man type suit, and they claimed to think he was the guy that was actually going around doing it. I personally don't believe in it. I used to work for the Forest Service for years. We used to see weird things going through the forest. I mean, not just animals, but you go far enough back there, you get some really strange people back in there. But I'll tell you, my guess would be it was just an abnormal bear, because I've seen deformities in animals too, so I can't say it's Bigfoot. I kind of rate that with the UFO scenario. I don't believe in it, but never seen it, and I guess I'd have to see one face to face. But because it's been proven a lot of these things have been doctored up, and I just was curious what your comment would be on that. Thanks, and I'll get off and listen.
Well, I think particularly, you know, you wonder for people who said that they thought that they saw Bigfoot or they saw something, whether in fact they might have seen something. And then the question is remains, well, what?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I'm not about to say that everybody involved in Bigfooting is either delusional or either a victim or a perpetrator of a hoax. I think there are actually earnest, honest people out there who've seen something they can't quite explain, whether that's a depression in the soil that looks somewhat like a footprint, or whether it's something that's moving through the woods. And then the question is, what is that? And for some people, Bigfoot suggests itself as a reasonable answer, and you'd have to kind of look at those people directly to see why they thought that was a reasonable answer. But I think there is some of that going on, that people are seeing something, experiencing something, and then kind of interpreting it as, or assuming it is, Bigfoot.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that I thought was kind of curious, and now we talked a little bit about the Patterson-Gimlin film that shows this creature, the alleged Bigfoot, that appears to be, in some respects, appears to be female. And you talked about the little earlier about this novel, about this Bigfoot-like creature that's female. What seemed to me, though, interesting is that so much of the time when people talk about Bigfoot, the presumption seems to be that Bigfoot is male. Now, you'd have to figure if there were Bigfeet, there would have to be both male and female. But am I right that so much of the time Bigfoot is male?
Yes. I mean, the assumption, kind of the baseline assumption, is that Bigfoot is male and that there is only one Bigfoot. And this is actually something that the Bigfoot community kind of rails against. It becomes this kind of shorthand in the press to refer to one male creature. But obviously, if you do believe in Bigfoot, then you have to believe in a breeding population of a minimum of probably 500 or more of these creatures out there. And you will see it among the Bigfooters themselves, they will point to some tracks that will have a large footprint next to a smaller one that they'll presume might be a mother and its cub or something. So there is this kind of, within the Bigfoot community, there's a broader understanding of what Bigfoot can be, the kind of forms that Bigfoot can come in, than in the kind of shorthand of the press.
You touch on something that is in those list of reasons that people give for why there couldn't be such a thing. I think scientists have said, well, look, okay, let us assume that such a thing did exist. Well, as you say, to have a breeding population, you would have to have a significant number of these creatures. And in fact, if there were that many of them, sightings would really have to be much more common than they are. There's no way that they could be so hidden that if there were 500 of them, they wouldn't be more frequently seen.
Exactly, and then it also points to the lack of other kinds of evidence. Why no bones? Why loggers never run one down while it was crossing the road in the middle of the night? Mm-hmm. And we have other large mammals that inhabit that same area, cougars and bears, and those animals leave other more definitive kinds of evidence behind of their existence than Bigfoot ever has.
Yeah. So, and just to, you know, we were talking earlier about the fact that in Tibet there were people who claimed that they had Yeti parts or Yeti skin, Yeti pelt, which when examined by scientists was determined to be some known animal like a bear or an antelope or something like that. But here in the United States, has anybody ever said that they in fact have more than footprints or the one movie, the Patterson-Gimlin movie? Anybody has ever said, oh yeah, I've got a piece of Yeti skin here for you?
Well, the Bigfoot, there is a kind of a tradition of finding Bigfoot fur. A couple of years ago was kind of the latest one that I can think of. That turned out, and that was up in Canada, that turned out to be bison fur. During some of the early expeditions in California, there was purportedly some fur found, but that turned out to be moose fur. And then there was another kind of famous discoverer of tracks named Paul Freeman, who worked in the 1980s, and he said that he had found some fur, and that turned out to be synthetic, probably from a wig, which raised, obviously, the suspicion of hoaxing. Mm. So there have been these cases, but, again, nothing's really ever come from them.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. Effingham, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Two quick comments. Thanks, David. The allusion a bit ago that your guest made about hard times and the distractions that Bigfoot provided, if I understood properly, and the image of Bigfoot and a single male, you know, just bare allusions to females, in my opinion, reinforces the paradigm of male domination and this monster who has all the power. Thanks, and I'll ring off.
Okay, I think there's a certain way in which Bigfoot is connected to kind of patriarchal ideas, but I think that is only one strand of it, and you'll see this from the other stories about where Bigfoot is also conceived of as a female. And then one other, I think, point I'd like to add to that is I don't know that I would say that the interest in Bigfoot in the 60s and 70s was a distraction so much as it was a way of kind of working through some of the emotions of going through those hard times.
Yeah, so it was one of those things where if you look at popular cultures, the stories that people tell, some people would argue that these stories tell you about what it is that people are worried about, what they're scared of, what they're thinking about, what preoccupies them, and those things made into stories.
Exactly right, yes. Yeah.
Woodridge, Illinois, next, line number one.
Hi.
Yeah, hi.
I've been studying this phenomena for a number of years, and as a matter of fact, I've even gone on a BFRO trip. I'm sure you're familiar with the BFRO website and that organization.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Bigfoot Field Research.
Have you guys taken a look at the reports that are continuing to come in? I mean, there's about 30 or 40 that appear every year, every month, from people around the country, and I think what's most phenomenal about that is that the reports mostly indicate that people aren't familiar with it. They are scared to report it because they know what's going to happen to them if they do. And another thing that I think needs to be brought out is that all of the sightings that occur in sightings where these Bigfoot could live. In other words, you don't see them occurring or appearing in the middle of a city, in suburban areas. The evidence shows that they are in rural areas where there has to be deer that they eat or other, cover for them to live in. And, also if you look at the physical capabilities of an animal like this, and how fast they are, how difficult they are, how stealth they are in moving and how strong they are, there's a lot of evidence that shows that these things actually do exist, that we just don't have the ability to detect them.
Well, Joshua, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, the book itself is not about debunking or proving Bigfoot. I have certain opinions based on kind of the research that I've done. If Bigfoot was found tomorrow, I'd be excited and overjoyed and think, wow, that was wonderful. I don't think it would change a lot of what I'm saying, because a lot of what I'm saying you can apply to living organisms just as well. It's kind of what I did in the first book, The Fire Ant Wars, which was kind of looked at how people thought about the animal, and that was a living animal that people knew existed. This is one that is more questionable about whether it exists, but there's still the idea is to kind of understand how and what Bigfoot represents and why it's interesting, yeah, and why there's commercials with it and such.
And I suppose it is true that there are a lot of people who would say, well, there are so many stories about these creatures, and people have continued to tell them over time. How could it be not true?
Yeah, And certainly there are. I think that kind of goes a little bit to the point that the caller brought up, though, about the all the stories kind of being about where Bigfoot is supposed to be found, because actually that's only a selection of the stories. There's actually a lot of stories about Bigfoot being found in swamps, Bigfoot being found in the desert. There was actually one in the late 1970s about Bigfoot being seen along the highway in Maryland, the interstate. So the kind of the ubiquity of the stories can cut both ways.
Yeah, and just one last thing. We all have about a minute that I think is really interesting, how this story has changed over time, how at times people have found this something to be afraid of. That Bigfoot has morphed now into a kind of spiritual ecological figure.
Yeah, it's really come to kind of, with the environmental movement, it's kind of come to represent the nature and kind of our obligations to nature. And while if we kept nature, then we're also going to keep this myth, because we'll be able to continue to imagine Bigfoot living in the woods, whether or not Bigfoot does.
Well, we're going to have to finish up. My thanks to the last caller and all the folks who called in. If you're interested in reading about this subject, you can take a look at the book we mentioned. It's titled Bigfoot, The Life and Times of a Legend. It's published by the University of Chicago Press by our guest Joshua Blue Booz. His last name is spelled B-U-H-S if you go looking for the book. And Mr. Booz, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. I had a great time.